Hey everyone, and welcome to the show. You know, when you think about it, Donald Trump's 2024 election, like seriously, think about it. After the January 6th riot, after being impeached again, most people I think would have just said, okay, he's done. But he didn't just fade away, like, no, he fought back. And he won. It's a political, I don't even know what to call it, resurrection, reinvention. It's so improbable, so unlikely. It's like something out of like a political thriller novel.
It really is. I mean, when you think back to where things stood in December of 2020, which is kind of the jumping off point for our deep dive today into Alex Eisenstadt's book, Revenge, the idea of a second Trump presidency. I mean, it just seemed like a fantasy, almost impossible. Yeah. You're talking about a defeated incumbent leaving office under, you know, a huge cloud of controversy.
So, okay, let's get into this journey. I mean, it's an amazing story. Revenge, which is based on, get this, over 300 interviews with insiders, doesn't just lay out what happened. It's like it pulls you right into the room for the strategy sessions and the arguments and, yeah, even the all-out political brawls. It's a really good read, and it gives you a look at the how and the who behind this crazy turn of events.
Right off the bat, what Eisenstadt makes clear is that even right after the election, those few weeks after, Trump wasn't acting like a defeated politician. He wasn't. I mean, he was already thinking about 2024 almost immediately.
Yeah, it's so different from how most former presidents act, right? Usually they step back, you know, write a book or two. But Trump's ambition was just different. I mean, think about guys like Carter or George H.W. Bush. You know, their post-presidency was nothing like this, this drive to get back in power.
No, not at all. Eisenstadt really highlights that single-minded focus Trump has on winning elections. Even with everything going on, you know, January 6th facing another impeachment trial, he's still focused on getting back to the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. Really unusual.
And here's where it gets even more interesting. Eisenstadt reveals that some early polling data, specifically from this Republican pollster, McLaughlin reassured Trump that he still had a really strong hold on Republican voters. That data, I mean, it wasn't just numbers. It was like, I don't know, fuel. It fueled his ambition to come back at a time when, you know, a lot of people were saying he was finished.
That early data was huge. It gave Trump that proof he needed, I think, you know, to back up his gut feeling that he wasn't done. And it helped push back against that whole idea that he was losing his grip on the party. It gave him the confidence to start planning his next move.
And these plans, it's not like they were some big secret. The book talks about how as early as spring of 2021, Trump was telling people pretty openly that he was going to run again. There's a story in the book about a golf game he had with Lindsey Graham where he just comes right out and says he has unfinished business. That's not just some offhand comment. It's a statement of intent.
That unfinished business line, it's very telling, I think. It shows that deep down, Trump felt like his time in office was cut short, you know. Like, he still had things to do, and that fueled his determination to get back.
Okay, so let's move on to the 2022 midterms. Now, Eisenstadt makes it clear that Trump saw these elections as a big test, a chance to show that his endorsement could make or break GOP candidates.
Definitely. He was backing candidates very strategically, knowing that if they won, it wouldn't just be good for the Republican Party, it would also make him look strong, like he was still the guy calling the shots. And that, of course, would be great for his own run for president.
But then something happened that could have been a disaster for anyone. The FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago, August 2022, right? They were after classified documents. But instead of backing down, Trump used this whole thing to fire up his supporters. Eisenstadt does a great job of showing that.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is how defiant Trump was right from the start. He truly seemed to believe that he had every right to have those documents. To him, the raid was an attack, a political hit job on a former president, something that had never been done before. Hmm. And his base, a lot of them already felt like they were under attack, so this message really resonated with them.
And the paranoia. The book talks about how everyone in Trump's inner circle was pointing fingers at each other, trying to figure out who might have leaked the info about the documents to the FBI. Some even thought it was DeSantis. It shows just how much suspicion and mistrust there was among Trump's closest allies.
That's so true. The fact that they were immediately looking for a traitor, basically, says a lot about how people in Trump's world interacted. You know, it was a very cutthroat, competitive environment.
There's this one exchange in the book that really stuck with me. It's right after the raid, and Trump asks Budowich, "What are we going to do about this?" And Budowich, without missing a beat, says, "We're going to fight." And that, I think, really sums up Trump's approach to everything. He's always on the offensive.
It's like every obstacle, every setback is just another chance for him to rally his troops, you know, to tap in that feeling that he's being wronged and that they need to fight back against these powerful forces that are trying to take him down.
Eisenstadt also talks about how Trump endorsed J.D. Vance in the Ohio Senate race, which was a big deal. And maybe even more importantly, he decided to wait to announce his own candidacy until after the midterms. The thinking there, it seems, was that he could take credit if Republicans did well and use that momentum for his own campaign. Pretty savvy move, right?
Definitely. It's classic politics. He wanted to be seen as the guy who can make Republicans win without actually being on the ballot himself.
Okay, now let's talk about some of the controversies Trump had to deal with. The dinner with, you know, Kanye West and Nick Fuentes. Eisenstadt goes into detail about the backlash Trump got for hanging out with Fuentes, who has a pretty long history of anti-Semitism and white supremacist views. It wasn't just a small thing. A lot of people were really upset about it.
Yeah, that was a tough one to defend, even for some of Trump's biggest supporters. Fuentes, especially, I mean, with his history of Holocaust denial and everything else,
yeah.
It was a big problem.
And it's kind of strange how that dinner even happened. The book says that Melo Yiannopoulos, who was the one who set it up, thought that Trump's inner circle was getting too moderate. So he wanted to bring Fuentes in, you know, as someone who was a true believer. It shows just how much access some of these fringe figures had to Trump.
It really does. It shows that sometimes people who were outside of the mainstream political world could influence Trump. You know, they could push him towards more extreme positions, and that could be dangerous.
So then we have Stephen Chung, who becomes the new campaign spokesman. Eisenstadt talks about how Chung, with his background in communications, was very aware of how bad the Fuentes dinner looked, and he tried to control the damage. It seems like he was a sign that the campaign was trying to be more careful about these kinds of things.
For Chung, definitely seemed to signal a shift in how the campaign was going to handle the media and deal with attacks. He was much more aggressive, much more willing to fight back and not just apologize.
It's interesting to compare the 2020 campaign, which was kind of all over the place, with the operation Susie Wiles ran in Florida, which was really smooth and effective. The book talks about how Trump saw how talented she was and wanted her advice after he left office. He knew he needed someone who could run a winning campaign.
Wiles was a total pro. She brought organization and experience to the table, which were things that had been missing in Trump's past campaigns. And she knew Florida politics inside and out. She's a huge asset.
And then there's the whole DeSantis thing. The book goes into how Trump just couldn't believe that DeSantis would actually run against him, you know, after Trump endorsed him and helped him get elected governor. It seems like Trump really believed in loyalty, like it was a personal thing for him.
I think Trump assumed that because he'd helped DeSantis, DeSantis would basically be in his debt forever.
Yeah.
You know, he underestimated DeSantis's ambition and the fact that a lot of Republicans were looking for someone who could give them Trump's policies without all the drama.
Right. Eisenstadt points out that DeSantis basically presented himself as Trump, but less crazy. He appealed to Republicans who liked Trump's ideas, but were tired of the constant chaos.
He was like a more polished, more predictable version of Trump.
The relationship with Fox News is another interesting thing Eisenstadt covers. It was up and down, you know, from Trump being furious about their Arizona call in 2020 to this all-out war between them later on. It was a crazy ride. There's this part in the book where Sean Hannity is basically begging Trump not to attack Fox or the Murdochs. It shows just how complicated things were between them.
That relationship was always this weird mix of mutual benefit and tension.
Mm-hmm.
Fox gave Trump a platform and a lot of positive coverage, but he always had this resentment towards Murdoch and felt like he was being treated unfairly. It was a delicate balance.
And Eisenstadt also talks about all these former allies of Trump, people like Reynolds, DeSantis, Pompeo, Haley, who all kind of turned on him. The book really captures how betrayed Trump felt by the Republican establishment. He felt like they only supported him when it was convenient for them.
Yeah, and that feeling of betrayal really resonated with his base,
yeah.
Who also felt like they were being ignored by the elites.
Yeah.
You know, it reinforced that whole outsider image that Trump cultivated so well.
So then we get to the official launch of the 2024 campaign at the Gaylord Resort in Maryland. And Trump delivers this line that really sticks with you. I am your warrior. I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution. That line, I mean, it sums up so much of what Trump is about.
It's a powerful message, especially for people who feel like they've been mistreated, forgotten, left behind.
Mm.
The promise of revenge, of someone fighting for them and against the people who hurt them, is very appealing to a lot of voters.
The book goes into detail about the behind-the-scenes discussions about strategy on Trump's plane. Susie Wiles seems to have played a really big role in crafting that message of retribution.
Yeah, Wiles brought a real focus to the campaign, a sense of discipline. She knew how to boil things down to simple messages that would resonate with people.
And then there's that crazy moment when Trump suddenly announces on Truth Social that he's about to be arrested. I mean, even his own team had no idea he was going to do that. It was completely out of the blue. It seems like he just acts on instinct sometimes.
It was classic Trump, you know, always trying to control the story, always trying to get ahead of things. By announcing it himself, he was basically trying to take the power away from the DA. And of course, it got everyone talking, which is what he wanted.
Okay, fast forward to April 2023. Trump has this dinner with Republican lawmakers in Nashville, and he basically says to them, "You're either with me or against me." It was a straight-up ultimatum. Eisenstadt really highlights that moment.
It shows how much power he still had over the party, you know. A lot of Republicans were scared to cross him because they knew he could ruin their careers if he wanted to.
And it wasn't just empty words. The book talks about how Trump's team was keeping track of DeSantis staffers who had criticized Trump. The message was clear. If you're not with us, you're against us, and there will be consequences.
That's a pretty chilling thought, right?
Yeah.
The idea that your political opinions could lead to you being blacklisted, essentially, is pretty scary.
And even with Republican donors, Trump wasn't shy about playing hardball. Even with guys like Charles Koop, who had opposed him before. Eisenstadt really shows how determined Trump was to get everyone on board, even if he had to bully them into it.
He was relentless. He believed in his movement so strongly that he thought everyone should be a part of it, even if they didn't agree with him on everything.
The book mentions that while Trump really respected Susie Wiles and how effective she was, he still kept some of those familiar dynamics from his old administration. Like, Boris Epstein was still a close advisor. It seems like Trump was comfortable with a certain amount of chaos around him.
I think he liked having people around who were fiercely loyal to him, even if they didn't always get along with everyone else. It was part of his management style, you know?
And then you have Natalie Harp, who Eisenstadt describes as Trump's human printer. She was so incredibly loyal to him, and she had this direct line to Trump that sometimes caused problems with the rest of the campaign staff.
Yeah, she was like his personal messenger. And because she had that special access to him, it created some friction with other people on the team. But she was always there for him no matter what.
There's this moment in the book where Trump calls Ronna McDaniel bird brain. It shows how blunt he was, even with the head of the RNC. But they still seem to have a working relationship, even if it was a little strained sometimes.
It's that weird mix of familiarity and disrespect that Trump seems to have with a lot of people.
And at the Iowa State game, Eisenstadt talks about how Trump only let his most diehard supporters into his booth. It's like he was constantly rewarding loyalty and keeping anyone who he thought wasn't fully on board at a distance.
It was very transactional. Like, you're either with me 100% or you're not in the club.
All right, so let's talk about Iowa and New Hampshire. Eisenstadt describes how Trump's victory in the Iowa caucuses was incredibly fast and decisive. And his team, I mean, they were celebrating, but it's almost like they were a little surprised by how big the win was.
Iowa was huge for Trump. It showed that he was still the guy in the Republican Party. And it gave him a ton of momentum going into New Hampshire.
And Trump, being Trump, immediately turned his attention to New Hampshire. There's this funny line in the book where he tells Susie Wiles that she gets to keep her job for another week. Even when he was winning, he couldn't resist putting a little pressure on people.
He always had to keep people on their toes, you know? Never let them get too comfortable.
And the celebrations continued, even with the E. Jean Carroll trial coming up. It's like the legal battles were just background noise at that point.
He was so used to being in court, it almost didn't faze him anymore, especially when he was winning elections.
Eisenstadt really emphasizes how much Trump's Iowa win meant to him, especially compared to 2016 when he came in second there. It was like redemption, a sign that he was even stronger this time around.
It showed that he had learned from his mistakes and that he had solidified his support in a key state.
And after Iowa, the relationship with DeSantis was officially over. Trump felt betrayed, like DeSantis had stabbed him in the back. It wasn't just politics, it was personal.
Trump took everything very personally. He felt like DeSantis owed him loyalty, and when DeSantis challenged him, it was like the ultimate betrayal.
Eisenstadt describes the scene in the war room in New Hampshire on primary night. All these potential VP picks are there, all these former rivals, and they're all basically trying to get on Trump's good side. It's like everyone wanted to be on the winning team.
They knew Trump was going to be the nominee, and they wanted to be a part of it. They wanted a piece of the action.
And Nikki Haley loses by 11 points. Not even close. And Ronna McDaniel, she's ready to declare Trump the nominee right then and there. She wanted to end the primary and unify the party behind Trump.
It was a smart move. The longer the primary dragged on, the more damage it could do to the party. It was time to rally everyone behind Trump.
But Trump was annoyed that Haley didn't drop out after New Hampshire. He felt like she was wasting everyone's time. And that was it for her VP chances, according to Eisenstadt.
He wanted people to fall in line. He didn't like it when people defied him.
And then there's Ron McDaniel's departure from the RNC. Trump was criticizing her publicly, and it seemed like his allies were pushing her out. It wasn't a clean break.
It was more like a power play, you know? Trump wanted to have complete control over the RNC, and he used his allies to get what he wanted.
And Eisenstadt suggests that McDaniel knew she was on her way out and didn't even try to fight it. She probably realized that it was a losing battle.
After dealing with Trump for so long, she knew how he operated, and she knew when to cut her losses.
Okay, so now let's get into this idea of retribution. Eisenstadt describes Trump's response to Biden's State of the Union address. He says, with a wink and a nod, that he has no interest in revenge. But it's pretty obvious that he doesn't mean it.
Yeah, that was classic Trump. Saying one thing, but meaning something else entirely. He might have said he wasn't interested in revenge, but his actions said otherwise.
The book really emphasizes how much Trump wanted to get back at the people he felt had wronged him in 2020 and who were opposing him in 2024. He was still attacking Liz Cheney, and he even talked about using federal law enforcement to go after his enemies. That's a pretty scary thought.
It raised serious questions about whether he would abuse his power if he got back into office.
And his support for the January 6th rioters was really disturbing. He kept saying they were treated unfairly, and he even recorded a song with them. Eisenstadt doesn't shy away from this stuff.
It was a dangerous game he was playing. By aligning himself so closely with the rioters, he was alienating a lot of voters, especially moderates.
Some of Trump's advisors, even people like Lindsey Graham, were worried about how much he was focusing on January 6th and revenge. They thought it would hurt him in the election.
They were right to be worried. Voters in the suburbs, the ones who decide elections, weren't going to be happy about a president who seemed obsessed with getting revenge.
And then there's that infamous day one comment. Trump said that he wouldn't abuse his power except on the first day. It was supposed to be a joke, but it didn't land well.
It sounded like he was admitting that he would abuse his power. And that's not something voters want to hear from their president.
And his rhetoric just kept getting more and more intense. He was talking about bedlam if he lost the election because of the indictments. And he refused to tell his supporters not to resort to violence. Eisenstadt describes all of this, and it paints a really scary picture.
It was like he was trying to create a climate of fear and instability. And that's never a good thing in a democracy.
Vince Haley, who was Trump's policy director, knew that the Democrats were trying to make Trump look like a dangerous authoritarian. And Eisenstadt tells this story about how Haley warned Trump right before a Fox News town hall that he needed to condemn violence.
There were people in Trump's own camp who knew that his rhetoric was going too far. They were trying to rein him in, but it wasn't always easy.
And eventually Trump kind of backtracked. He said that he wouldn't have time for revenge and that our ultimate retribution is success. It seemed like he was trying to soften his image a bit.
Maybe he realized that all this talk about revenge wasn't helping him with voters.
But the damage was done. Eisenstadt makes it clear that Biden's campaign kept using Trump's words against him. They were reminding voters of all the times he talked about revenge and how dangerous that could be.
It was a smart strategy. They were playing on people's fears about Trump's temperament and what he might do if he got back into power.
All right, so let's talk about Roe v. Wade. When it was overturned, Eisenstadt says that Trump's first reaction was to ask if he would be blamed. It shows how politically sensitive the issue of abortion had become.
He knew that while overturning Roe was a victory for the anti-abortion movement, it was also going to energize pro-choice voters. And he didn't want to be caught in the middle of that fight.
The book talks about how Trump had to walk this really fine line on abortion. He needed to keep the religious conservatives happy, but he also didn't want to alienate moderate voters. It was a tough balancing act.
It was. And he didn't always handle it well. He would say one thing one day and then contradict himself the next. It was confusing and it made him look indecisive.
And after Dobbs, each state was basically doing its own thing on abortion. There was no real national Republican strategy.
It was a mess, and it just made the issue even more complicated and divisive.
But within the campaign, according to Eisenstadt, they decided that the best approach was to just let the states handle abortion. They thought that would be the safest option for Trump politically.
It allowed him to avoid taking a firm stance on a really controversial issue. But it also meant that he wasn't really leading on the issue, which could be seen as a weakness.
Senator Katie Britt called Trump to talk about how important the abortion issue was, and they worked together on a social media statement about it. It shows how some Republicans were really trying to shape Trump's message on this.
They knew it was a crucial issue for voters, and they wanted to make sure Trump didn't mess it up.
Now, let's not forget about all the legal trouble Trump was still facing. Eisenstadt acknowledges all the lawsuits and investigations, especially the Carroll case and the hush money case in New York. It was a lot to deal with.
It was a constant distraction and made it harder for Trump to focus on the campaign and his message.
The book goes into the big financial hit Trump took in the Carroll case. And as usual, he just kept denying everything, wouldn't admit any wrongdoing.
That was his go-to move. Just deny, deny, deny.
The criminal trial in Manhattan was a big deal, too. Eisenstadt says that it really threatened Trump's image of being in control. He couldn't just bully his way out of this one. He had to face a judge and a jury.
It was a humbling experience for him, I think. He wasn't used to being in a situation where he didn't have all the power.
But what's interesting is that Eisenstadt says that during this time, Trump actually seemed calmer. He was more appreciative of Susie Wiles and what she was doing for the campaign. He was even listening to feedback more and showing an interest in history. It's almost like all this pressure was having a weird effect on him.
It's possible that he was maturing a bit, you know. Maybe he was realizing that he needed to change his approach.
And Melania, she was pretty much invisible during the campaign. She made a few appearances, but she mostly stayed out of the spotlight.
It seemed like she was trying to keep her distance from all the craziness.
Eisenstadt says that within the campaign, people were pretty sure that Trump was going to be convicted in the Manhattan case. They saw it as almost inevitable.
It must have been a tough pill to swallow, knowing that their candidate was facing serious legal trouble.
Tony Fabrizio, who was Trump's pollster, he had a reputation for being a straight shooter, you know? He wasn't afraid to tell Trump the truth, even if it was bad news. And he had been right about some big things before, like when he warned Trump about the impact of COVID back in 2020. So when he started a new polling project to see how the hush money trial might affect the campaign, people paid attention.
Fabrizio was a numbers guy. He believed in data. And he didn't let his personal feelings get in the way of his analysis.
Eisenstadt mentions how the campaign was trying to show support for Jewish students, you know, with all the anti-Israel protests going on. And Trump even visited a bodega in Harlem. They were clearly trying to reach out to different groups of voters.
They were trying to broaden his appeal beyond his base. But it's hard to say how effective those efforts really were.
In the hush money trial, the prosecution's main argument was that Trump had falsified business records to help his campaign in 2016. That was the heart of their case.
It was a pretty serious accusation. If they could prove it, it would be a major blow to Trump.
Eisenstadt describes how Trump prepared for his first debate with Biden. Jason Miller and Stephen Miller were running things, and they were taking it very seriously. It seemed like they knew how important this debate was.
They had learned from past mistakes. They knew they couldn't just wing it.
And they were convinced that the moderators would be biased against Trump. That was a big part of their thinking going into the debate.
They always felt like the media was out to get Trump.
What's funny is that Trump was actually worried about Biden's mental state.
Yeah.
He was afraid that he might accidentally knock him out of the race if he was too aggressive in the debate. It's a strange thing to worry about.
He was trying to figure out how to attack Biden without making it seem like he's picking on an old man.
The book mentions this debate memo that was full of suggested comebacks and zingers. They were really trying to come up with lines that would go viral.
They knew that sound bites were important. They wanted to create moments that people would talk about.
And it seems like they were successful. Most people thought that Biden did really badly in that first debate. He had a lot of gaffes, and Trump was able to score some points. It was a turning point in the race.
Biden looked tired and confused, and Trump looked energized and sharp. It was a bad night for Biden.
After that debate, there was a lot of talk about whether Biden should drop out of the race. Some Democrats were really panicking.
It was a real crisis for them. They had to figure out how to stop the bleeding.
Now let's talk about something really scary, the assassination attempt. Eisenstadt describes Trump's rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, and he mentions that the group traveling with Trump was smaller than usual, probably because of security concerns.
They were definitely more worried about security after the Mar-a-Lago raid and everything else that had been going on.
And there's this interview with Tucker Carlson where he asks Trump point blank if he thinks someone's going to try to kill him. It was a chilling moment.
It showed how real the threats were. Trump was a polarizing figure, and there were people out there who hated him enough to want him dead.
And Eisenstadt reminds us about the threat from Iran, which was still very real after the Soleimani assassination.
That was a constant worry for the Secret Service. They knew that Trump was a target.
But even with all these threats, Trump still insisted on doing things like wading into a crowd of fans before a football game. He wanted to be close to his supporters, even if it meant putting himself at risk.
It was part of his appeal, you know, that he was willing to break down the barriers and connect with people on a personal level, but it also made him a more vulnerable target.
And then it happened. Eisenstadt describes the assassination attempt at the golf course in detail. He talks about the shooter, Ruth, and his motives. It's a terrifying story.
It's a reminder that political violence is a real threat in this country, and it's something we need to take seriously.
The Secret Service acted quickly, and Trump was thankfully unharmed. Eisenstadt says that Trump was surprisingly calm throughout the whole ordeal.
Maybe he was in shock, or maybe he was just used to dealing with danger.
The book mentions that Jared and Ivanka were waiting for Trump at Bedminster after the shooting. It shows how much these threats affected his family, too.
It's easy to forget that these politicians are also human beings with families who worry about them.
After the shooting, security was even tighter. There were a few other incidents, too, like a car window being smashed and a potential attack on the motorcade, and a drone was even shot down. It was clear that the threats were serious.
The Secret Service had their work cut out for them. They had to be constantly vigilant.
Trump had to change his routines, he couldn't golf anymore, and his events were smaller and more often held indoors. It was a big adjustment for him.
He was used to being out in the open, connecting with crowds, but now he had to be more careful.
Wiles was really pushing for more Secret Service protection for Trump. She knew how dangerous things were.
She was looking out for him. She knew that his safety was paramount.
But Trump still insisted on going to the Georgia-Alabama football game. He wasn't going to let the threats stop him from living his life.
It was a show of defiance, a way of saying that he wouldn't be intimidated.
Okay, let's talk about the VP selection. Eisenstadt says that Trump was still making up his mind about his running mate at the very last minute. He was even considering people like Maria Bartiromo and Harris Faulkner.
It sounds like he was having trouble making a decision.
Susie Wiles joked that Trump wanted a unicorn for a VP. It was her way of saying that he was looking for someone who didn't exist.
He wanted someone who was loyal, experienced, charismatic, and who could appeal to a wide range of voters. It's a tall order.
The book explains why he didn't pick people like Youngkin, Ramaswamy, Haley, or Britt. Some of the reasons were pretty strange, like he was worried about Youngkin being too tall.
It shows how much personality played into his decisions.
Yeah.
He was looking for a certain fed, a certain vibe.
And then there's J.D. Vance. He had been a never-Trumper, but he had a change of heart.
It's a pretty amazing story, actually.
Eisenstadt describes this moment when Vance saw Trump connect with people in East Palestine, Ohio, after the train derailment. It seems like that was a big turning point for him. He saw a different side of Trump.
He saw that Trump genuinely cared about these people, and that impressed him.
Fabrizio, the pollster, he predicted that Vance would be one of the top VP contenders. He had a good feel for what Trump was thinking.
He knew that Trump liked Vance's background and his message.
At first, Vance wasn't so sure about being VP, but then he decided to go for it.
He realized that it was a huge opportunity, and he thought he could make a difference.
The book talks about how Vance campaigned for the VP slot. He did media appearances, raised money in Silicon Valley, and got support from people like Don Jr., Tucker Carlson, and even Elon Musk.
He's working hard to build a coalition of support.
But there was resistance, too. Peter Thiel warned Vance that the Republican establishment wouldn't be happy if he was picked. And Ken Griffin tried to talk Trump out of choosing him.
There were definitely people who saw Vance as a threat.
And Eisenstadt describes this scene in Atlanta where all the VP contenders are gathered for a debate. There's a lot of tension and competition between them. They all want to be the chosen one.
It's a high-stakes game.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of pressure on these people.
So now we get to this period that Eisenstadt calls the tour of self-destruction. And it starts with a flight to Aspen, Colorado on Jeffrey Epstein's old plane.
That's not a good start. It's like a bad omen.
Eisenstadt says that even though things were looking good in the polls, Trump was still worried about losing. He couldn't shake the memory of 2020.
He knew that anything could happen, and he didn't want to get his hopes up too high.
When Biden dropped out of the race, it was chaos. Trump was actually angry about it. He felt like he was being cheated out of a fair fight.
It's like he wanted to prove